Could you please introduce yourself? Who are you and what do you do and what are your qualifications?
Yes. Hi. So my first name is Imani and then surname is Carter-Hale. I am a U.S. trained marriage and family therapist. I specialize in trauma. I then moved across the pond to London and I decided to do a second master's in clinical psychology, and then register here in London as a family and systemic psychotherapist. So same thing, just different across the pond.
Different location.
Yeah.
On the topic of what happens when sudden illness or a diagnosis or disease comes into a relationship, be it romantic or a friendship, and trying to come to peace with that kind of sudden onset. What are some of the main stresses that come with this sudden introduction of illness or disease to a relationship?
So it's interesting because we can't predict when the intensity of a sudden physical ailment is going to impact an individual or their relationship. Granted, we may have an idea of how intense, based on from medical standpoints, maybe how intense the physical ailment may impact the individual, but you really can't predict how impactful it is in the way in which it impacts them on an individual level and a relational level. I think one thing that really is important to remember is that stress is going to happen. Stress is going to happen in any part of our lives. But when you introduce physical or mental ailments that can be really impactful on the individual's everyday outlook and just their quality of life, I would say that stress can then impact the way that they relate to others, the way they feel others are relating to them. And that's really significant to the way that they may communicate their needs or not communicate those needs.
Mm-hmm. And how do people take on these new roles? When we spoke in the pre-interview, you mentioned the kind of distinction between somebody who's potentially a sufferer and somebody who is a caregiver. And all of a sudden, you've mentioned now the big stressor is just the complete change in dynamic, change in role, change in relation to each other. How do people usually take on their new roles? And is there a right or a wrong way of doing it?
So it's really interesting because a lot of people, I think, hate to hear the saying of it all goes back to childhood. And one thing you will frequently hear me say is a lot of it actually does link back to early childhood and adolescent experiences, simply because the way in which we form bonds early in our life with our caregivers and with others, that completely impacts the way we then relate within these interpersonal dynamics. So if someone leans into a caregiver role very naturally, what that tells me is maybe there's some type of anxious attachment within their dynamics that they've always experienced, but it's just that this particular ailment is exacerbating it. So what that may look like is if someone typically find themselves people-pleasing, maybe they've always done it in relationships. But in this case, it's intensified because the person that they're in this dynamic with is needing more support. They may feel more comfort in pleasing that person, whether that be one thing that we commonly see is someone leaning into caring for others despite it being a detriment to self. And that's a really big one because you could almost say that, doesn't it just mean that someone cares about them? I wouldn't discount that they care about that person. What I would say is if they are finding themselves engaging in behavior simply out of the benefit of others, though it's detrimental to themselves, I would say that they're leaning into caregiving behavior. You're completely forgetting about your own needs.
And then to look at it from the other angle, in your experience, what has that looked like in terms of being somebody who now is in the vulnerable position, is the sufferer, is in need of help, and is finding themselves in a position where they have to actively ask for it, or sometimes they can't even ask for it, they just have to accept that it's coming their way. How do they navigate that?
And I think that's a difficult one because if someone has never experienced any forms of like disappointment or anything where they've needed to rely on others. Naturally, so it can be difficult to find comfort in relying on others. But again, also, when I go back to attachment, we think about wounds. Very early on in our lives, we can experience attachment wounds with our caregivers. If our physical needs aren't being met, our emotional needs, our mental needs, our cognitive needs, if these needs are not being met early on in our attachment, what can happen is we can experience these attachment wounds, which can then make it difficult for us to attach to others. What I will say is these wounds are not lifelong. Now, they can feel like they are, but what may happen is someone who has experienced significant attachment wounds may very well struggle to say, I need support, or even find the words to admit to self, because the first step is admitting to self that I need some support and that it's okay to need support from others. If you don't feel that it's okay to get support from others, you may then struggle to accept that, or you may find that someone that is trying to support you, you may see that as a threat to self and a threat to independence. That can be really difficult to then accept that support and kind of self-reflect and say, you know what, it's okay for me to need support from others. But again, if you don't think it's okay, you may very well feel that support, your perception of support, may be a perception of a threat to self and independence.
Mm-hmm. So on that, how would you advise people to begin that process of adapting? Is there a... I realize, obviously, it's very nuanced, and in this episode itself, we're speaking about physical ailments. We're also speaking about the disease of addiction. It's a very broad scope, and obviously, each is different to each person. You know, your disease or diagnosis has entered the relationship. Now what? Is there a first step to adapting? Is there a process that we should be following?
So, what I would say is there's no process. However, I would say one of the first steps is self-reflecting on the impact that it's having on yourself. And what I would say that may look like is thinking about, how do I feel? And I think a big part of it is you can physically know you don't feel well, but are you checking in with your body? A big part of self-reflective experiences is thinking about, how is this experience impacting how I feel? Have I actually thought about what those feelings are? For example, a lot of people very easily turn to anger. And what I typically say is anger is actually a secondary emotion. When we think about an iceberg, anger is the tip of the iceberg. But underneath that, there are an astonishing amount of emotions that we are experiencing and feeling and coursing through our bodies. But we typically lean into anger. If someone does something to you and you say, oh my God, I can't believe you did this to me. How could you make me feel this way? What I'm hearing is betrayal. I'm not hearing anger. I'm hearing betrayal. You're saying you're angry. Again, anger is a valid emotion. However, it essentially is a secondary emotion. And in saying that, what that means is that what we need to do to be more self-reflective is really think about, how do we feel about this experience? In what way is it impacting our body, our emotions, our mood? Are we noticing our sleep patterns are different, our eating patterns? Are we feeling more irritable? The only way that we're able to check in with ourselves is if we are able to have the capability to be self-reflective. In saying that, I recognize that not everybody has the skill set to do that. And that's simply because most people haven't been taught to check in with our bodies, check in with our emotions. What are we feeling? The scope of our emotions. Again, we're saying we're angry, but are we feeling disappointed? Are we feeling betrayed? Are we feeling lonely? We may be responding with anger, but are we feeling something differently? And anger feels to be more accessible, because many people don't know this. When we learn about our emotions, we learn about the top five: anger, sadness, happiness, contentment, and jealousy. You usually learn about these five emotions and you think that this is like the range of human emotions. But in reality, as we're aware, it's not the range. It just feels more accessible because it's the most talked about of the emotions.
Where would I even begin to look into educating myself? You're saying some people just don't know. So if I'm a listener and I'm listening to this and I'm being like, okay, I resonate, I understand what I need to do, but I have no idea where to start. Do you have any advice on that?
what I will say is, obviously, being a therapist, I love therapy. I think therapy is amazing. Mm-hmm. For, again, therapy is not accessible to everybody. So I think if it's accessible, that's wonderful. Seek out the support. What I would say is there are so many different platforms that allow affordable support, where they'll work with you on a sliding scale so that they can support you. Again, keeping in mind, if you can't do that, one thing that I've realized is that, and I realized it very early on within my career and within my journey, is that the internet can be an amazing tool. It can also be a difficult tool and a harmful tool, but it can also be amazing because it's really easy, I would say, to find information on positive psychology, on mindfulness. One thing that I would say is look into apps, look into mindfulness apps. They very easily walk you through different ways to be mindful and reconnect with your body. Because essentially what I'm talking about is one of the first stages and steps of being mindful and being aware, having this awareness of what am I feeling in my body? How is it presenting itself in my life? And then in what way is that then impacting the way that I relate and attach to others? So I would say look into different mindfulness apps. You may find that the first part of your journey is you doing a lot of the footwork in looking into these different apps and looking into these different platforms that are allowing you to connect with your body in the way that you feel. So number one is these mindfulness apps. And if you can seek additional support, do, because there are many platforms that allow for these sliding scales to meet your financial needs.
Yeah. And would you say this applies to both parties, the caregiver and the afflicted person?
Yes, because I think that it's fair to say, and many people have different views about this, but it's fair to say that both parties are going to experience a range of emotions, and all those emotions are valid. And it's really important that both people know that their emotions are valid. One person's emotional experience and response is not more valid than the other, simply because it's directly happening to them physically or mentally. The other individual is just as valid because they're experiencing the secondary effects of the emotional experience that someone is going through in that moment. So I think that it's important to recognize that both parties are valid in their responses, in their emotional responses. That looks very different than behavior response. And I do say that because the way we emotionally feel is always valid. The way we behaviorally respond can either serve us or not serve us. And that's why those two things are very different.
Understood. And what are your thoughts on just kind of speaking to support and support networks? You know, how important is it for people to be relying on friends and family in these situations?
Oh, it's so important. It is actually really important that we have other support networks outside of our partner. If you found that support networks that you've had are only your partner, again, going back to attachment, is there some level of codependency? Is there safety in having this one person be your end-all be-all, as I like to say, support network? It may feel comfortable for you because it's what you're used to. However, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's serving you in your growth as an individual, simply because you're not allowing yourself to build trust within other attachments within your life. But also, you aren't necessarily encouraging and allowing that other person to then do the same. And I think that's important, is recognizing that, are we encouraging self and are we encouraging others? What I will say is it's no one's responsibility how codependent someone else is with them. Again, we can't control someone else's behavior. What we can do is we can acknowledge how our behavior is exacerbating a situation. And if we feel that it's not serving us, we can make that change for self. We can't force someone else to change their behavior.
Yeah.
If they're not wanting to have support outside of that interpersonal dynamic, if we're feeling that it's not serving us, we have to say something. We can't necessarily, we can't wait for someone else to decide for us that it's not serving us. Because you'll never have control over the things that are happening to us if we're never allowing ourselves to be in the driving seat. And essentially that's what it is. What we're doing is, by never putting ourselves in the driver's seat, it allows us to say, these things are happening to us. But in reality, there are some things that we can get ahead of or that we can mitigate the effects if we remove ourselves from the passenger seat and put ourselves in the driving seat by deciding, I no longer want this to impact me the way it is. I'm going to make personal changes.
Yeah, it sounds like we're getting into boundaries, and I'm assuming here, but I'm assuming boundaries are crucial in navigating this new stressor or this conflict that has come into the relationship, be it a friendship or, like you've been speaking about, a partner relationship as well. What do these boundaries actually look like? How do you find boundaries? How do you recognize what your boundary is? And how should people communicate these boundaries?
So boundaries are very interesting because I think prior to starting my journey to working in the field of mental health, I didn't actually really think about boundaries. Like most people, we go through our day to day and you're not thinking about what boundaries you need to apply and what capacity they may present themselves, who would be including those boundaries. But one thing I always say is all, and I think this is what's most shocking for people to hear, is that personal boundaries are literally just limits. They're limits that we set for ourselves within relationships. A lot of the times we talk about boundaries as if they're for other people, but in reality, boundaries are for us. And I think the important thing is remembering is that when you are thinking about what it is that you're going to allow in your life, you're not thinking about the other person. You're thinking about what is it that you will allow yourself to sustain, to experience. And I think the first step in thinking about boundaries is remembering that it is okay to say no, and that you're saying no for self, not for others. And I think a lot of times that can be really confusing for people because, again, we think about boundaries and we think, okay, so then who does that apply to? And I always say to people, everybody, literally every person in your life, you should have some form of a boundary with, whether it's a friend, whether it's a colleague, an associate, a family member, a partner. All people, all relationships in your life should have some form of boundaries because, again, they are the limits and they are the rules within relationships that we're building. They allow us to decide how comfortable we are opening up to someone, the level of intimacy that we want in relationships. And one thing that I really like to do with people when we're thinking about boundaries is, I'm not sure if you've ever heard of boundary circles. A really great tool, actually, that has been created and used by many therapists and many social workers, because it's a tool, again, that's helping you to self-reflect. But essentially, boundary circles are allowing you to think about yourself and then also think about yourself as you relate to others. Who gets to be in your inner circle? What does that even mean? What does that look like? What is your inner circle? Who gets to be in those spaces? In what capacity are they allowed to move from inner circle to middle circle to outer circle? And I think it's really important when we're thinking about boundaries is thinking about, again, what are the rules within your inner circle, your middle circle, and your outer circle? What does that look like? What are these limits within these spaces? Because essentially, our boundaries are based on our values. What are important to us? So if something is important to you, if the way someone communicates to you, communicates with you is important, what does that mean? For example, does it mean that you won't allow people to yell at you? Okay, that's a fair boundary. If you say, the way that I like people to communicate with me is in a kind of, I guess I'd say, a middle tone, let's say that. And let's look, and I'd say, okay, so what is a middle tone? And they say, I just don't like when people yell at me. It's triggering when people raise their voices. So on one end, you have someone saying, I don't like to be yelled at. I don't like screaming. It's triggering for me. On the other end, I would say, we'd explore that. But when we look at boundaries, I'd say, what is it exactly that you want from the person then? Because if you don't know what it is that you want, they can't know what it is that you want. And what I'd say is, okay, so then communicate that. You'd say, please don't yell at me. Moving forward, I'd like us to communicate in a steady tone. Yelling is very triggering for me. It brings up really harmful memories. I prefer that you did not speak to me that way. Now, let's say you communicate that boundary. You say, please don't do this, or I'm not comfortable with the way you're speaking to me. That's okay for you to say that. And I think that's the important thing is people many times people are saying, is it okay for me to have boundaries? And I say, absolutely. If you don't have limits and rules within your relationships, you can't possibly know what it is that you want people in the way in which you want people to speak to you. Or I take it a step further, or I'd say the way in which you are allowing others to have access to you. So if you don't want people to yell at you, if you're not communicating that boundary, they won't know that it's not appropriate. It's up to you to communicate that boundary with others. But if you don't know that you're not okay with it, they won't know that you're not okay with it. So it goes back to being self-reflective on what are you okay with? What will you allow within your relationships?
Continuing with boundaries and the communication of boundaries, but also, as you said, knowing what your boundaries are, or at least feeling confident in communicating those boundaries. I can imagine it being incredibly difficult as a caregiver to be friends with somebody who is currently struggling with something, to feel like it is your place to say, hey, I know you that you are hurting, or I know that you're in pain, but using your example, please don't yell at me. How do we navigate that? How do we navigate this kind of feeling of guilt for putting our needs forward when somebody else's needs are seemingly more dire than yours?
I think that's an interesting question, because it's almost a question of, rather than is it okay for me to feel guilt? Because it's okay to feel anything. I think that's the big thing, is it's okay to feel anything. But what is this emotional response going to, in what way is this emotional response impacting the behavioral choices I'm making? So we can say, you know what, we can sit and we can self-reflect. And I always say journaling, by the way. Journaling is a great way of like practicing self-reflective behavior. So if you're saying, you know what, I don't like the way they are speaking to me. I don't like the way they're yelling. I understand that they're in pain. I understand that maybe their quality of life is not what it was or what they would like it to be. But I just don't like the way it feels when they yell at me. It makes me feel that I don't matter. If you're finding yourself kind of self-reflecting and you're saying, I feel guilty, again, I'll go back to saying it's okay to feel guilt. However, if that guilt is impacting the way in which you communicate your needs, this is, I think, the difficult part for people to hear, is that it's then on you to decide, what does it mean for me moving forward? So does it mean that I continue to allow this behavior simply because they're in pain? Or does it mean that I communicate to the best of my ability that I don't appreciate the way you're speaking to me? And I think sometimes that's a difficult thing, is what I'm saying is, I'm not saying it's okay for that person to yell at you. What I am saying is that they only have control over themselves, just as you do. If you are not liking the way they're communicating with you, you have to communicate your needs and what it is that you feel. You can't expect someone to know that their behavior is negatively impacting you. No one is a mind reader. And I think I'll hear a lot of people say things like, they should know they made me feel this way. And I say, why? Why should they know they've made you feel a certain way? Why should they know that their behavior is impacting you if you aren't communicating the impact that it's having? So if you're continuously leaning into a dynamic where you're not communicating, clearly communicating your wants and your needs, you can't expect them to know you're feeling this way, just as they can't expect you to know.
Yeah.
Or just as they can't. Yeah, exactly that. They can't expect you to know, or them to be aware of what they've made you feel, and vice versa.
Yeah.
No one's a mind reader. And though it's easy to say they wouldn't want to be treated this way or they'd feel this way, again, we can't predict how they'd feel, because as humans, we could experience the exact same experience and have different perceptions of said experience. Mm-hmm. Just as we could have this experience and feel different things. Mm-hmm. No one human is going to feel the exact same thing when you put the exact same picture in front of them, essentially.
Yeah. From your experience, and maybe we can reflect from both perspectives, on from the caregiver side and the sufferer side, how do they navigate, or how should one navigate expectation? how, if, you know, in the caregiver is in the name. There is this expectation to give care. And there is also, there are also expectations of, you know, somebody who is suffering with something. There's, but then there's the real life experience that is often very different to that. In your experience, what are these expectations and how should we deal with them moving forward?
Yeah, so there's like varying expectations. However, I think in the, when we look at, let's start with the caregiver. In the word alone, it's that you're almost just providing care to someone who needs it, essentially. There's this expectation that the caregiver should be there continuously. That's a really big one, is that they should always be available, like readily available to provide this level of care. And I say this in saying a caregiver that has decided to take on that role, because you can decide to become a caregiver or you can unknowingly place yourself in a caregiver role. But if we're speaking about someone who chooses to be a caregiver, they are almost expected to be readily available for that individual to meet the individual or individual's needs. Despite them having personal boundaries, they may not be expected to enact those boundaries. Because again, that may, there may be a perception that having these boundaries in place are impacting and affecting their ability to care give appropriately. So there's this end of it, which I talk about, that I say it with caution because that is difficult for any human to be readily available, to put aside their needs and their wants and their values for the benefit of others, though it may be to the detriment of self. That is difficult for anyone to do. And if anyone is saying they're doing it, I challenge them in saying, but to what capacity are you doing it? And how is it impacting you? Because we can say we're doing things perfectly and not realize the impact that it's having on one's life. So when we think about caregiver from that standpoint, there's this need to be loving also, caring, kind, always. I use the word always because there's almost this idea that they always need to display these behaviors to be an effective caregiver. So we look at it, we have this standpoint. And then on the other end, we have someone who is considered the sufferer. And I think in that, what that means is, again, in the word, is that they're always suffering. And again, I'm speaking in absolutes right now, because in a way, this is the way in which it's conceptualized. But in reality, there's not absolutes. So when we're thinking about it in this concept, it is someone who's just like always suffering, their quality of life is significantly impacted, and they are struggling to feel encouraged to communicate their wants and needs. And I think that's interesting because they may have personal wants and needs and values, but they may not feel encouraged to voice them, or they may not feel that it's appropriate to voice them because of the place in which they're in the dynamic. And so I think that there are different factors that contribute to both of these titles and these roles that people take on. Mm-hmm. And again, and speaking about them in absolutes, it's to say that this may be how many people view them, but it is not necessarily how they view self. And I think that's the difficult part, is then you have these feelings come up, these feelings of guilt that both parties can experience. They may look differently, they may present differently, but you have these sets of traits and characteristics that may invoke these feelings, for example, of guilt. Mm. And that's just one feeling that they may experience.
Yeah. I have a question here, and it's that, I don't know if you know that Reddit thread, the Am I the Asshole? There's a Reddit
thread. I think I've seen it.
Yeah. So in a lot of my research in trying to understand these dynamics and get, you know, a broader perspective, as you'd said, not working in absolutes, but finding the nuance there, a lot of what comes up is, I don't want to be the caregiver. I want to be the friend. I guess this is a two-part, and I'll ask the follow-up question. But to start, it's, I don't want to be a caregiver. That's somebody else's role. I want to be a friend, and a friend in my, whatever that means, and in my capacity. But often that's not received very well in the why can't I just be your friend? Why does there have to be an element of caregiving in there? And am I the asshole for not having capacity to give you what you are expecting from a friend?
It is interesting, I think, because as friendships are interesting, any relationship is interesting, but friendships are particularly interesting simply because in everything that you said, a lot of what stuck out to me is like capacity. Do I have the capacity, or rather I don't have the capacity? What I would say is, again, and I think this is a really big part of the practice I do, is accountability. Many people, that word, I think it's hot in social media right now. It's really big on TikTok. It's really big on Instagram. But it's really, what does accountability mean? Does accountability mean that I'm saying I want these things to change and I'm doing nothing to change them? No, that's the thing with accountability. Accountability is recognizing, what do I have the capacity for? So doing that self-reflective work, what do I have the capacity for? In what way am I going to communicate that capacity? And if I notice no change in that relationship, what does that mean for me moving forward? And I think that's the big part of accountability is, again, people will choose to behave accordingly. However, you can also make the choice to behave accordingly. If you are allowing treatment, then you are going to continue to allow yourself to feel this way. No one can make the change except for self. And I think that's a really difficult thing for people to understand, especially when we're thinking about relationships with where people are very obviously, and I put it in quotes, obviously the sufferer. The reason I put that in quotes is because someone may obviously present as a sufferer and not necessarily recognize the impact that their behavior is then having on others that are also suffering as well. And I think that is an interesting concept because, again, it goes back to this idea that we can't control how someone behaves, but we can control how we allow someone to behave in our presence. Mm-hmm. When we think about boundaries, what are our limits? What are the personal limits? Have we actually set them? Have we communicated them? Do we even know what the limits are? Again, yeah, it goes back to being accountable for self and how I allow people to have access to self. If I'm saying, and I think that Reddit thread is really interesting. If I'm saying, I don't want to be treated this way, but I'm continuously allowing treatment, you may not want to, but your behavior is indicative of you wanting to be treated that way because you are not making any changes.
Yeah. To throw a curveball here though, a lot of the responses are, someone says, one of the threads was someone who was in high school and this friend kept canceling last minute and would make plans and kept canceling plans because they were in chronic pain. But at the same time, this friend is being canceled on. And so the friend put in the post, I can't be friends with this person anymore because I am just being hurt and disappointed. And the feedback was brutal. Reddit came for that person and said, you know that your friend is in pain. You know that your friend needs at least some sort of kindness and understanding, not you walking away. So how do we navigate that? We've spoken about accountability. Do we stand accountable to our choice and come to peace with the fact that my needs as the friend who wants to, I don't know, go to a concert are not being met and the other person's needs for a caregiver are not being met? And maybe at this point we part ways? Or is there a different way of navigating that?
I think it's, first, Reddit can be very, very brutal.
It is incredibly brutal. Yeah.
It is a brutal, I would say, a lot of social media platforms, but like Reddit and I would say TikTok, the comments, people will come for you. It's difficult. I think it's difficult to accept that person may not have the capacity at that moment to show up for you in the way that you'd show up for them. And it's okay to say, I've decided not to continue this relationship because I feel hurt, and explain what that hurt is. And it's okay to feel that hurt and to decide to remove someone from your inner circle. We, just because someone is presently suffering, it does not mean that we have to accept all forms of treatment. It doesn't mean that we have to be this like end all be all understanding person. Because if I were to take it a step further, I'd say, do we know about this individual's attachment wounds? Is the individual that's continuously being canceled on, how is this impacting their attachment wounds, if any? If they're feeling like someone is being inconsistent, how are they feeling that's a reflection of self? And again, these are really big questions that I would ask someone, but I think it's important to acknowledge that just because someone is in pain or they're suffering, it doesn't make behavior okay. And I think that's a really difficult thing to sit with because it's nothing that you can do, obviously. You can't change their situation suddenly, just as they can't change how their behavior is impacting you. But what you can do is decide what it is that you're willing to deal with in the moment. It's okay. It doesn't mean that they will always be in this spot. However, it's not your job to have endless capacity for others. We as humans can't do that. We just can't do it. It's not within our capacity as mammals to do that. We can't say that we'll always allow someone to be in our lives, to treat us a certain way. And I think that's a big part of it. If I were to take it a step further, it's this idea that we have to always have people in our lives, that there's this conceptualization around forever relationships. And that's not the case. Relationships are seasons. And I think that can be really difficult for people to understand, is that some seasons are longer than others. And it's okay. It's okay if you have a season where someone is within their season and it's years. That's okay. Just as it's okay, whereas a relationship is maybe only a season for a couple months, it doesn't take away from the significance in which that relationship has had in your life. It doesn't take away from the good that you've had. It doesn't automatically eliminate the good simply because the season has ended or you're considering ending the season. And I think that's something important.
So how would you walk a quote-unquote sufferer? And I do want to get into the language as well, because I fear that I've been using incorrect terms this entire interview, but hopefully we can get to that. But for the person who has been diagnosed, as you said, you know, the clear sufferer in this case, whether it is clear or not, how would you walk them through coming to peace with the idea that someone had said, our season is over, I can't do this? How do you come to peace with that? How do you come to terms with that?
What I would say is, think about what it is within the relationship that has made you say, I can't do it anymore. Because I think what's going to happen is, let's say you have the conversation with the individual and they say, what is it that you can't do? And you bring out a list of things. Is that fair that you've sat on these feelings and not communicated your needs? I don't know that's necessarily fair to self. And it's interesting that I said that because it's not even that it's not fair to the other person. We're going to get to that, but it's not fair to self. You're doing a disadvantage to yourself if you have not consistently communicated those needs. If you've essentially sat on these feelings and if you've ever been in a situation where you're just like, oh, I can't believe this happens. And you find yourself feeling more and more frustrated and you find yourself at your wit's end in a relationship. At what point did you start to notice that happen? Because it didn't just happen. It was a culmination of experiences that you chose not to address for whatever the reason may be. And again, when we're using this language, keep in mind, there's no blame. Because if you may not have had the capacity to communicate your needs, so there's also that aspect. You may not have had the capacity to communicate because you may not have had the language to do. However, in recognizing that, you have to recognize that if someone responds in a way that you may feel is exaggerated, keep in mind that you haven't been communicating your needs the entire time, or at least you may not have been communicating them clearly. And so be aware that the response that you may get may not be pleasant, number one. However, in saying that, recognizing that it's not your responsibility to control the response the person is giving. So I would say, prior to having the conversation with someone, think about what it is that you haven't communicated and think about why. What was stopping you from communicating your needs? Was it the language? Was it the situation? What about the situational environment that has stopped you from communicating your needs? And also, reflect on what it is that you'd like to do differently moving forward. Because it's your responsibility to set the limits and the rules within your relationships and the way in which it will impact self. So really thinking about what it is that you need moving forward in relationships.
And what about for myself as the hypothetical sufferer, with coming to peace, not just with the idea of somebody just communicating with me and telling me I'm done. How do I accept that somebody is going to make a decision that feels incredibly hurtful to me? And on the flip side as well, how do I come to peace with the fact that my life has changed? I might have to be canceling on people. I can't be there. I can't be the friend that I wanted to be. I can't be the partner that I want to be. How do I come to peace with all these changes in my life?
What I would say is the biggest part of coming to peace with those changes is communicating. Communicating to others that I won't have the capacity to show up for you in the way that I may have shown up or the way that I'd like to show up for you. I'm giving you this information and it's going to allow you to decide what you're going to do with that information. And I think that's where accountability comes in for not only the individual who's not experiencing and living with, you know, whether it's mental illness or physical ailment, but also the individual that's experiencing these different changes and these sudden changes in their life is to say that I'm going to communicate, this is where I'm at and this is what I can do. And if that is not within your capacity to deal with, I understand. And I'm going to allow you to decide. Because again, it's not fair to yourself to not allow yourself to decide and communicate to self, well, this is where I'm at. I think the first step really is not only communicating that, but also saying, also accepting that this is where you're at. And that can be really difficult, is accepting that your life has changed and it's going to look different. And because it's going to look different, I need to accept that there are going to be changes that I need to make for myself and for the people in my life. And I need to allow them the choice. Do they want to continue in my life or do they not want to? If they choose not to, remembering, I think the biggest thing I would say is also adding is remembering it is not a reflection of self. And that's a really significant thing, is realizing that because someone chooses to no longer be involved with you, it's not a reflection of who you are as a person. You may be engaging in behavior that is not serving them in the way in which they want to engage with others, but it doesn't mean that it's a reflection of who you are as a person or that you can't make these changes. Because we are ever growing as humans, and in being that, we can make changes within ourselves. And we also have to accept that people are going to make changes within their relationships.
I wanted to come to as well an idea that I came across, or an experience that I came across a lot in my research, is fear. And when I, as the caregiver in my family or a friend, has been diagnosed with something, for example, and a lot of people walk away, not for a lack of care, but just a fear at being confronted with this really scary thing that is happening to somebody that they love. How would you advise them to navigate that, to come to terms with those feelings? Is fear something that I'm supposed to be overcoming, or is that also something that I just accept as part of my process?
One of the first things I would say is thinking about, when you think about relationships, do you typically find yourself walking away out of fear of the unknown? And if the question is yes, I would say thinking about why that is. What about not knowing what's going to happen next is scary for you? And again, I want to say that can be scary for anybody. Like if I don't know where this person is in my life, for example, I use an example of relationships. We like to have certainty in our relationships, whether they're intimate or not, we like to have some level of certainty of, is this person going to be around? If we, a lot of times as humans, if we don't know that there's some level of certainty, very naturally, it can invoke feelings of nervousness and worry and concern. Really normal feelings to have when you don't have a level of certainty in relationships. However, if you're finding that you need concrete certainty that someone will always be in your life in the same capacity that they were, then I would ask you to self-reflect on, why that is. Why is it that there is difficulty around dealing and coping with change? Because ultimately, that's not a them thing. That's a you thing. They're coping and they're trying to deal with or even trying to understand the changes that they're going through. For you as an individual, what is it about the uncertainty and change in particular makes it difficult for you to cope? Why does change feel scary? What about change are you worried about? And I think that is a big part of, again, doing the self-reflective work and doing the mindfulness work, whether it's the deep breathing, whether it's the journaling, doing this self-reflective work and asking yourself, what about this feels scary? Like, why am I so afraid that I am walking away before having to deal with any of the change? And I think that is significant in thinking about, is coping with change is the bigger question. Have you always struggled to cope with change? In what way have you coped with change in the past? Have you typically avoided it? What does that avoidance look like? And these are really big questions that you start to ask yourself when you're faced with the possibility of changes happening within your relationships.
I wanted to circle back to anger. Anger is something that has come up a lot in the conversations that I've had in the preparation of this piece. It's something that, as you said, is kind of like the tip of the iceberg, and there's obviously so much below that. But anger is still real. And do you have any advice on where to put that anger, where to direct that anger when you are feeling those emotions? If, for example, your partner has put you in this position, whether, you know, it was through alcoholism or some sort of other drug abuse, or you're angry because they've been diagnosed with cancer, for example, and you feel it in you and it needs to come out somewhere. Do you have advice for that? Where should it go? And how do you hold it or let it go?
So it's interesting because, as you said, anger is real. Despite it being secondary, it's still a very real emotion that all humans experience. And it's interesting because there are different ways to kind of effectively deal with your anger. But one way that is very common to many people is, I would say, if you're noticing that you feel angry with self or other as you're going through this change, one way is very simple: walking away. Although that, and I think that's interesting in itself, because then we think about, what if walking away is triggering for the other person? Communicate while you're walking away. Let them know, you know what? I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this right now. I need to take time to think about what I'm feeling, and then I'll talk to you when I'm ready. It is okay to walk away and say, I can't do this right now. It's okay to do that. It's also okay to, like I said, take some deep breaths. A lot of times I say this to people and they're like, oh, we breathe in our everyday life. And I'm like, yes, we do breathe in our everyday life. That is true. However, deep breathing is so incredibly effective. And I literally walk through the steps of deep breathing. And I literally say, close your eyes, lay down or sit down. In some way, you want to be connected to the present. You want to be connected to the here and now. Because when we're angry, we are responding to a stressor. And we have this cortisol. Cortisol is the stress hormone. It's running through, it's coursing through us when we are experiencing some form of a threat. And so if you're responding to that cortisol and that stress hormone is going through your body and you're feeling yourself be angry, you are not actually focused on breathing. You're not actually focused on that in that moment. So that's why I say deep breathing can be really effective, because it forces you to come back to the present and to the here and now. So again, going back, I say either lay down or sit up. Some way you want to be connected so that you know you're real. Because when you're angry, you can feel so out of place that you're responding to that anger that you're not actually rationalizing. You're struggling to rationalize in that moment because you're feeling so triggered. So you would close your eyes, you'd breathe in through your nose. And I always say count to four, breathe out through your mouth. And I say do that about 3 to 4 times. Deep breathing can be incredibly effective when you are needing to self-regulate because you are finding yourself rationalizing and you are supplying oxygen through your body and you're releasing that cortisol. You're reducing the way in which that cortisol is impacting your overall decision making. So deep breathing is another one. Move your body, move around, whether it means you are going for a walk. If you can't run, go for a walk. Go for a 5-minute walk if you can do that. If you can run, get your blood pumping, do some running. Again, I've mentioned this a few times, but it's because I absolutely love it. Journaling. Journaling is like one of the most powerful things that you can do. You are allowing yourself to really write down or type out what it is that you're feeling and why it is that you're feeling that way. Mm-hmm. Again, one way is box your paper is a way that it's called, or box your anger is a way that it's called. But essentially what you're doing in that moment is you are releasing your anger in a way that may feel constructive for some, but may not feel constructive for others. Whether it be hitting a pillow, making a like anger ball, so writing down everything that you are angry about, putting it in a ball of paper, and then literally just squeezing it. Another way is maybe if you can do some hiking, if you have hiking in your area, going and hiking and literally screaming. A lot of people don't know this, but screaming can be really effective as an mm-hmm. emotional release, whether it's in a pillow, whether you're going on a hike and you scream it out. Who cares who's around? You need to allow yourself to get the oxygen flowing so that you can start to think about what it is that you're actually angry about, because it's mm-hmm. usually deeper than the surface level. And it allows you, once you release that oxygen into your body and you're kind of removing and releasing and reducing this cortisol, it allows you to start to have the space to think about, what about this situation is actually angering me? What is it that mm-hmm. I actually feel about this?
Yeah, I think it's been anger is a tricky one, in that the anger is very valid. There is an element, at least from myself, this element of sympathy with, oh, this person is going through so much already and now having to navigate my anger or somebody else's anger as well. And there's this, I don't know, it could really just be me, but this excess of sympathy for them is something that I found quite interesting as well, in terms of why is it that we often do not give room for anger? Why is it that it doesn't seem like it has a place when the other person is clearly suffering and doesn't need to deal with my anger either?
Yeah. And you know what? What I will say is many people would agree with you. Like, I understand that. I understand feeling like it, questioning, is it okay for me to be angry? Is it appropriate? Where do I put this anger? And I think the one thing that's important to realize is that you... And I think this is what's difficult. A lot of people hear this and they're just like, oh, they feel really, it's very interesting. They'll hear it and they're like, can you further explain? You are not responsible for someone else's anger. You are only responsible for your own anger. And you're responsible for how you respond to that anger. But you are not responsible. If we were responsible for everything everybody felt, there would never be any level of self-accountability. Because we'd always feel we were responsible for every feeling that every person was experiencing. We can't hold that level of responsibility. We actually really can't hold it. We'll notice that it starts to impact our mental health, our physical health in various ways, whether we're not sleeping much, we're not eating much, we're irritable. We find ourselves being really snappy. You know, these are ways that what we call as like somatic symptoms. So the way that our presentations can then manifest and impact our body and the way in which we respond physically and emotionally to experiences. If we find ourselves trying to be responsible for everybody's feelings, you may very well find that is going to impact the way that you relate to others and to self. Because we just can't be responsible for everybody's feelings. It's not our job to do so. We can acknowledge how our behavior is impacting someone, but we aren't responsible for how they feel.
Thank you. You've already stayed with me so long, and I'm really grateful for the time that you've given. But I'd like to just wrap with a question around language. When we first spoke, you brought that up in conversation, in needing to be mindful of the terms that we use when we describe people. Is somebody a sufferer, or is somebody a victim? Or, you know, is somebody the caregiver? You know, are they the friend? You know, I'm throwing words out there. You're the expert here. But do you have any advice for those looking to navigate these new situations that they might be experiencing, especially when it comes down to communication and communicating needs and boundaries? Where do we need to be careful with regards to language?
So language is important, because we don't want to use language that could be harmful in the way in which not only we say it, but also in the way in which the person may interpret. Again, we can't control how they may interpret it, but what we can do is we can ensure that we're talking about mental health and physical health in a way that the person feels understood and valid and valued rather than insulted. So it's interesting, because what I would say is, when we use language such as mental illness, physical illness, it can almost feel like we are describing that as a personal trait of the individual. Mm-hmm. So rather than saying that, what I would encourage others to do is say living with, whether it's like living with cancer, living with addiction. When we use language such as living with, what you're doing is you're acknowledging that this is what this person is experiencing rather than this is who they are. Because what will happen is we can use language and it can say, oh, you're crazy, for example, or, oh, this is just because you're sick. That's not validating at all. That's really actually invalidating. And it can be really insulting. So what I would say is using language that starts with living with or presently experiencing. And that is because you want to remove what the person is experiencing. You want to remove it from it being a trait of theirs, or looking at it as it's a character trait of that individual rather than it's something that they're currently experiencing. Victim is interesting. And I think it's interesting because I wouldn't say that it's bad. And I typically don't say things are like bad or good, because those are subjective terms. I usually say things like, is it serving or not serving? But I think that when we think about victim, being that some people may not feel like a victim, I caution on using the word victim, and rather I say survivor, because they are surviving. Despite their present or past or future experiences, they are surviving. And I tend to say survivor rather than victim, because victim can, again, not only can it feel insulting, it can feel as if they aren't able to move past their past, present, or future experiences. And that's not the case. Someone can be living with the physical ailment and still survive that, and still be surviving that experience. Mm-hmm. And then caregiver is one that is a commonly used phrase, and it can be helpful in that it allows someone to think about and self-reflect on how their behavior may be indicative of caregiving behavior. And so I would say that can actually be a helpful term to allow someone to be self-reflective on their experiences and their behavior. Again, it doesn't mean that they'll always be a caregiver, rather that they may be leaning into caregiving behavior.
Thank you so much for taking the time to chat. It was all incredibly insightful and very helpful.
Yes, thank you so much. I really enjoyed this.